Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. In the woods around Bernd Heinrich's New England home, summer is on the way. Nature is on a tight schedule, and Heinrich has to keep up. The nuthatches are building their nest holes now. Queen hornets are starting their hives. The clock is ticking, and there's a riot of activity in the woods out there. This hour on Point, watching summer with naturalist and author Bernd Heinrich. You can join the conversation. Are you paying attention? Do you feel the woods outside your home rushing to its chores? Joining me now in the studio is Bernd Heinrich. He's professor emeritus of biology at the University of Vermont. He's a contributor to Scientific American, American Scientist, and more, the author of many, many books. And his most recent is Summer World, A Season of Bounty. How nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. Tell our listeners how you prepared this most wonderfully written book about summer.
Well, thank you very much. preparation is kind of at different levels. Every day in the morning, especially at daybreak, I go out in the woods and around the house and see what's going on and watch the seasons. And I'm basically always looking for surprises, which sometimes have led to discoveries and research papers. But I think for this book, I was mostly trying to capture what's going on. And
For two years you did.
I do it now. I mean, I've done it with my previous books, too. It's always taking notes and trying to get the larger context of what's going on. And looking for what stands out in with reference to what I know from standpoint as a biologist where I was trained, and in the context of what I saw before, because things change from day to day and from year to year.
In your book, you say that summer is a time of courting, of birthing, of foraging and feeding, and that timing is everything during the summertime for insects and animals. Is that not right?
Yes, timing is very important, especially in the northern hemisphere, because the summers are so short. You know, the further north you go, the shorter the summer. And for birds, for example, let's say in the extreme, in the Arctic, they have to come there from continent away and come up there and find mates and build nests and court and incubate the eggs and rear the young so that they're big enough and strong enough to be able to migrate back when winter comes, which they can't survive. So it's very important to get there early.
You say the main order of business in summer for animals and insects is reproduction. And the window of opportunity is short.
Yes, just several months, 2 or 3 months, and even less in some places.
Nature's on a tight schedule.
On a tight schedule, that's yeah. Right. So I have to be out there every single morning. I can't miss a one.
So tell us about some of the things. Tell us about some of the more interesting things that you saw in your preparation for observing summer.
Some of the interesting things I saw. Well, for one thing, I started out the book talking about wood frogs because they are so conspicuous early in the beginning of the summer, which I conflate with spring here, and they're so noisy and showy. So there, and then of course birds come, and I always recognize and expect certain ones,
You write in the book about, it captured my attention, the secret spectacles of wasps that you say made clay pots that they stuffed with live drug spiders. Tell me this story. What happens with the wasps in summertime?
Well, there are so many wasps, and I think I was intrigued with the wasps because they do so many different things. I mean, the hornets type of wasp and yellow jackets, they build nests out of paper. So they're the original discoverers of making paper from paper pulp. And then there are, you know, mud daubers and who make clay pots and clay vesicles, some that look almost like real clay pots that people use. And they put a drug prey in there for the larvae to eat for the food. And so these mud daubers, I hadn't seen them around a house until I happened to be out there. In fact, last year I didn't see them at all, so I was lucky and took the advantage. And then actually saw another wasp carrying pieces of grass, and I just couldn't believe it. So I got really interested, just from a theoretical perspective, how these behaviors are programmed, because these animals don't learn anything from anybody. They never see their parents, and they
of course, it's instinctive.
Yes, it's instinctive. Yes. But the thing is, there's a whole, it's not just, let's say, do one thing like pick up something, but they go through a whole program. They have to hunt in a certain place and find the spider and sting it in a certain way and build this clay pot in just exactly the right shape.
Tell us the story, Berndt, about the caterpillars, because I was stunned by your story about the caterpillars that devise this way of fooling predatory birds and ants to either ignore them or to take care of them. Is that not right?
Yes, many of the the blues, a family of butterflies, and there is the spring azure is one that we should see about now in New England. It's a tiny little blue butterfly, and it's very, very pretty. Flutters close to the forest floor, and the caterpillars feed on violets. And many of these blues are protected by ants. Where they feed, they exude little sugar droplets, and the ants feed on them and basically keep predators away. And some species have gone so far that with a symbiosis with the ants, that they get carried into the nest of the ants and actually start eating the larvae.
Hmm.
And there they end up being predators. So there are all kinds of different relationships. And I talked about some of the tropical ones, which are much more sophisticated and very kind of bizarre relationships.
Mm, mm. You know, there's one point in the book where you talked about, well, I'll quote you, one of the most conspicuous and stunningly beautiful seasonal phenomena in the North Temperate Zone is the flowering and leafing out of the northern forest. You say both the flowering and the leafing out determine the insect populations, which in turn make the summer world possible for the majority of birds and for most mammals. Flowering and tree leafing, they're precisely scheduled events. Is that not right?
Yes.
And how does that impact the rest of summer and the rest of the insect population, the birds that fly in? How does that? How does it all work together?
Well, of course, many insects get their food from pollen, many species of bees. There are hundreds of different species, and many feed on the nectar. Flies and butterflies and moths and all of these become later on fodder for birds. So they don't only feed on nectar, but it's a big, very important energy source for many of them. And matter of fact, the flowering is going on right now. And my drive from Burlington to Boston yesterday, I was thinking about, you know, I saw flowers, millions of flowers all along the way, just always had flowers in sight. And I was thinking, you know, most of us aren't really aware of all the flowers out there. Of course, these flowers are not meant to attract bees. These were, you know, pollinated by the wind, so they weren't very conspicuous.
Mm.
But right now is the time that, you know, the poplars and the red maples and elms are blooming. And
what's your strongest impulse, Berndt Heinrich? Is it the curiosity of a scientist, a naturalist, or the writer's need to tell the stories about what you find?
Well, it's hard to say which is the strongest. I think they both go together. I mean, I they're definitely, you know, I have a very strong instinct to go out there and see what's going on. And that's because that's just a lot of fun. And that's what I do just for the heck of it, for the fun of it. But sometimes it turns into a project, and then it becomes a piece of science, you know. And so it's kind of stray observations that pop up. You have no idea what's going to be there, and suddenly you see it, and then the scientist takes over.
You grew up in Maine. From the time you were 10, tramping around the woods with your dad, collecting insects and birds and all sorts of things. What is your aim now? Is it to teach? Is it to inspire? What is it?
Well, I certainly would love to inspire. That would be great. You know, I am inspired, and so, you know, it's fun to be able to pass it on if I could. It's fun to, you know, preserve it. I feel when I'm writing it, I'm preserving memories and what I've seen, and it gives me pleasure to go back later on and say, yeah, this I remember this now. This is great, and so it's preserving what I've seen and to put it together in a way that others would enjoy it, I hope.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Those are the sounds of spring peepers and wood frogs by a roadside on a summer night. We're talking about nature's busiest season, summertime, and what exactly the frogs, the trees, the insects, and birds are up to these days. My guest is naturalist Bernd Heinrich, who is out with a new book called Summer World, A Season of Bounty. Let's go right to the phones. We get loaded with calls here. First to Stowe, Vermont. Evelyn is on the line. Evelyn, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to say that sort of a rite of spring where I live. I live up in Stowe, and it's a very alpine climate, Stowe, Vermont. I have a pond and a 16-year-old border collie. You know, what we do is usually this time of the year, we enjoy the beautiful sound of the peepers on the pond, the frogs. And we go down and we walk around the pond, and one thing that really amazes me is the fact that the peepers will be peeping, and it's just this wonderful, joyous noise and music that they make. And then as soon as I get to the pond, the big frog, and I've seen the big frog, I don't know if it's a male or a female, makes this particular command, and then all of the frogs become completely still and quiet until I leave. And it's almost, to me, it's like such a consciousness. And then at night, they do a symphony. And it's amazing because there's an actual order to the sounds of the peepers. And there's like a building and a building. And it really sounds like an orchestrated piece. And then it becomes completely still. Mm. And I find that really just miraculous that, you know, where they get this consciousness and where they get this knowledge of and what they are doing, and I just wanted to share that.
Well, that's wonderful. Evelyn, thanks so much for your call. Bernd, you describe in the book the chorus of wood frogs as an impressive expenditure of energy. Would you describe for us what you hear when you hear frogs, wood frogs?
Well, I am interested in the expense that goes into it and what they get out of it. So I'm a kind of an economist, I guess, ecologist, but I'm also, of course, interested in the beauty of the chorus, and certainly at least the wood frogs, they try to call together as a chorus, actually. So if you record the sounds, and first of all, if you go near the pond, you don't have to be a big frog. Or if you are a big frog, they will all shut up because they don't want to be located by some big animal that they can see. There are lots of things that could potentially grab them, so it's a big cost to call. So a lot of them like to call at night instead, and especially the spring peepers and the wood frogs will later on call mostly at night. But anyways, if you play back the call, they will all chime in.
Hmm.
And when they don't call, they usually dive to the bottom, and then you call, and they start popping up to the surface all over the place, and they all start in.
In the book, you say, if an animal's main summer preoccupation is a race of reproduction, then the chorus of wood frogs on a night in early April is the starting gun. Is that right?
That's what I say. Well, I'm reminded of running, I guess. So,
as a marathoner yourself,
right.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Hello. I hope you can hear me. I'm on a cell phone.
I can hear you. Go ahead.
When I lived in D.C. about 20 years ago, I went out one evening. I love watching The Small World. And I saw a pair of slugs on the wall, and they were smashing each other, jamming each other with these interesting spikes or proboscis that had come out of their mouth area. And it was very fascinating to watch them because they were either very angry with each other and fighting, or they were very passionate toward each other and mating. And I was curious if your guest knew what was going on. Mm. And I'm going to take my answer off the air because my connection is very poor. Mm.
Jim, thank you. Appreciate your call. Barrett?
Well, I don't think there would be fighting. I've never seen slugs fighting, but I've seen them mating, so it's probably what it was.
Annie is on the line now from Fort Myers, Florida. Annie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, my question is not as happy. I'd like to ask Dr. Heinrich what he knows about ectoparasites, number one, bird mites, and number two, that age-old question why one can be bitten by a mosquito and sitting right next to their husband or someone who is not getting bitten, and what his opinion is on... Is it our diet? Is it hormones? Is it I've heard all sorts of things about why insects bite some people and don't bite others. Mm. And I am taking garlic, by the way, right now. And
hoping that'll help.
I don't know if that works, but that's what I'm doing.
Annie, thanks. I'm interested in the answer as well. Mm. Barrett?
Well, I've certainly heard that garlic is effective. I don't know. I like garlic, and I don't seem to be bothered that much by them, but maybe I've got a thick skin. But anyway, yeah, certainly I've seen people who, the black flies don't go near them. Other people are just mobbed with them. They are, attracted to carbon dioxide, and everybody releases that, but there are also other body odors that are released that also attract them. So there's a whole cocktail of scents that they go by. But I don't know specifically which scents they are and why they, any one person might be attractive or not attractive. Mm. But it is related to scent.
Barney's on the line from Only, Virginia. Barney, welcome.
Hi. This is an interesting topic. I'm a big-time bird watcher on the Virginia Eastern Shore. We have a lot of birds, and I put out bluebird boxes, and sometimes the bluebirds come to them, and sometimes these house sparrows come and they destroy the nest. Hmm. And I was just wondering, I hate to destroy, them, but is there a way that you can keep the house sparrows away? I don't even know if that's a topic for this show, but I was just listening, and I was just curious because the bluebirds around where I live are numerous, and they're my favorite.
Barney, thanks.
I would guess house sparrows would like to be closer to bushes and houses and buildings and so on where there's cover. Bluebirds tend to like it more in the open, be more tolerant of it. So if you have them out into the field, I suspect you'd have it being more attractive to the bluebirds and less to the house sparrows, just for a guess.
Talk about some of the birds that you refer to in the book. I was interested to read about ravens and to hear how intelligent they are, that they indeed use logic to solve problems. Is that true?
Well, yeah, I did some experiments that suggest logic by the process of elimination. I mean, you can solve a problem by random chance, by instinct, or by figuring things out, and the only way to test is to present the animal with something totally new that they have not encountered before that requires numerous steps, and so I could explain that. But
the ravens are clever, they're social, and they respond to human gaze, in fact.
That's right. They are very responsive to human gaze and gaze of each other as well. Very, very keen.
How do birds generally start their summer?
speak about some of the birds that you mentioned in the book, Canadian geese, the red-winged blackbirds, and some of the rest.
Well, I've watched Canadian geese quite a bit because we have some near our house. There's a beaver pond, and I got to know some of the geese as individuals, not by catching them and marking them, but by looking, by watching them every day, and I got to see the white face patch patterns and their slight differences in the configuration. And then I had we had pet ones and got to know them very well. And I wrote that about that experience of several years in the geese of Beaver Bog. So one of the first things they do when they come back in early spring is there's a lot of fighting going on, and I always was very curious why they would fight. And then later on, after they've hatched out the young, they build nests there, and then they all go through the woods like 2 or 3 miles away, and where there's actually a smaller pond, and they gather from all different areas, and there they don't fight at all. So these were little problems that popped up that I was very interested in and that I pursued, and that's why I wrote the book, The Summer World. So again, it related to problems, interesting things that were happening.
Here's the sound of a yellow belly sapsucker that was recorded in western Massachusetts. So the yellow belly sapsucker is a great example of completely different animal species, in effect, collaborating, right? Tell us about the importance of of sap licks that they make on trees in the woods.
Well, first of all, this what we just heard wasn't one sapsucker, it was several, at least a couple. And they were probably not cooperating, they were probably fighting. They had an antagonistic interaction. And probably had a sap lick somebody had made and the other wanted to get in on it. So they make sap licks, and basically the family feeds there. They're one of the, you know, the sapsuckers are very unique woodpeckers in the sense that that they basically hammer only in live trees where the sap is running, and then the sap runs out and the water evaporates and they lick it up, then at this sap many animals come. And in the north here, for example, the hummingbirds come long before there are any flowers that they can feed on. So right now we can start getting hummingbirds even though before they're flowers, and they'll be feeding on the sap licks. And of course many insects, yellow jackets, hornets, red squirrels, and flying squirrels, and butterflies.
We just put a hummingbird feeder up in the backyard. We'll see if we get some. We'll see if you're right. Al is on the line from Fairfield, Vermont. Al, welcome to On Point.
Yes, thank you. I guess no one looks forward to warming weather in spring and summer more eagerly than the folks who live in northern Vermont. I'm 30 miles north of where your guest teaches, and there are several harbingers of spring that I have seen already. Of course, the most important to us is that my wood pile, we heat with wood, my wood pile has just about disappeared, but also kestrels appear along the dirt road where I live. Of course, geese heading north, and there's a remarkable situation along a main highway here. Ospreys have reoccupied a twig nest on top of a telephone pole in Fairfield Swamp. They built the nest last year, and it's quite a remarkable thing. I drove into town this morning, and there was one of the ospreys with his or her head above the nest. But also, 2.5 weeks ago, entering my garage to get some wood, actually, I saw what I thought was an American lady butterfly. And I looked it up, and it said that the American lady butterfly is one of the few butterflies that winters over as a butterfly. And I wish your guest would explain how that's done, and if indeed that's so.
Thank you so much, Al, for your call. So to Al's question about wintering over as a butterfly.
Yes. It's interesting. Many Lepidoptera, moths, and butterflies, they overwinter, have several. Some of them in the egg stage, some of them in the larval stage, some of them in the pupal stage, and there are a few that overwinter in the adult stage, and the mourning cloak is usually the first one I see in the spring. And, you know, people remark, you know, there's still snow on the ground and you see a butterfly. They're usually a little bit dopey at that time, but they're out. This group of butterflies related to the mourning cloak, like the American lady and several others, overwinter as adults. I have looked long and hard to find hibernating butterflies, and I have never actually seen them, but I know they do. In the fall, I see them fluttering around the house and the cabin, which makes me think they probably go into crevices and dry crevices, like, you know, ladybird beetles do, and
to wait out that
season. Lace wings and cluster flies. Mm. You know, so there are a number of insects that overwinter as adults.
Back to the phone. Sandy is on the line from Coventry, Connecticut. Welcome to the program, Sandy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I am calling about witnessing the wonders of spring this morning. My husband and I are biologists, and we own a farm.
Ah.
And the last couple of mornings, when my husband has been out filling the water trough for our cows, we raise Scottish Highlands here, and they're the red, long-haired, shaggy cows. There have been two chickadees that have landed on the fence right next to him. Yesterday morning they had straw that they had taken from the bedding to put in their nest, but this morning they seemed to be quite happy with themselves. They had the long strands of red hair from the cows that they had gathered and are taking to their nest. And it was remarkable. It's remarkable the things that we find in the nest of the birds around here. Sometimes it's horse hair, sometimes the hair from the cows, or even dogs. When we comb our dogs, we put the hair, the fur out, so that the birds can use it in their nests. And they're really quite quite interesting to look at all the different things that they use in the building of their nest.
Mm-hmm. They sound quite industrious. Sandy, thanks so much for the perspective. You agree?
Yes. Many chickadees especially love hair and fuzzy and feathers, but different species of birds, other species of birds will never touch hair or feathers for their nest, and others will line them with feathers, and some like some flycatchers, and sometimes a wood thrush will use snake skins to decorate the nests, and some others like red-eyed vireo will use wasp paper to decorate the outside of the nest and never on the inside. On the inside they will not have hair, but they will have more thicker stuff like long pine needles and rootlets, but not feathers, and others will use mostly feathers.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about summertime with a man who has devoted his time and his eyes and ears, really his life, to watching it unfold in all its detail and urgency. My guest is naturalist Bernd Heinrich, whose new book is Summer World, A Season of Bounty. Professor, how do animals and plants know it's summertime?
I think there are about at least three different ways that both plants and animals, well, not plants, but plants and animals, first of all, can have 24-hour clocks, what they call circadian clocks. And with those, they could measure the hours of daylight or darkness, and the hours of daylight increase in the spring, and so you can tell when it is spring and summer is coming. Except, of course, in the fall, it's, again, very similar, and which is something I've been interested in because some of the spring flowers start to bloom again sort of haphazardly in the fall as though they're unsure of what season it really is. And some birds start to sing again in the fall, you'll hear them, whereas they'll be silent late in the summer. So that alone doesn't tell them what the season is. Experiments have been done with keeping birds, for example, and some mammals under constant conditions in the lab, and see that they go through the reproductive cycles on a yearly basis under constant conditions for several years, but they get out of phase with the real world, and they kind of lag behind or go ahead. And so in nature, they would synchronize, and they would do that probably with measuring the photoperiod and getting their annual cycle on time. And, of course, then the seasons change, the star patterns change with the seasons, too, and some birds can actually... they navigate by the sky pattern. So,
that was interesting. That I read that, and I thought that that was fascinating. That birds migrate at night, mainly mm-hmm. the small songbirds, mm-hmm. Migrating at night based on star patterns.
They use the star patterns to navigate by. Yes, and so in the spring they migrate using one direction. Let's say they flying towards the North Star, and in the fall they fly in the opposite direction. So apparently.
So do they migrate based on star patterns? Do
right.
they anticipate changing seasons from star patterns as well?
Possibly, potentially, yeah, because they orient differently in different seasons with respect to that. So presumably they can tell the season as well.
Let's go back to the phones now. Jim is on the line from Vermont. Welcome to the program, Jim. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for this program. And I'm a huge fan of Dr. Heinrich. I'm so happy to hear him speak. And I just have a comment, that is that his prose is so lovely and inspiring, and it's not just a scientific view of things. And I just want to read a two-sentence quote from The Trees in My Forest, and he's describing the forest as, quote, such a forest is also the diffuse lung tissue of the earth to which we are irrevocably bound. Sorry. It is not our environment. It is us. And I find this prose so inspiring and thorough-esque. And I just wanted to make that comment.
Oh, that's nice,
yeah, thank
Jim.
You
thank
much.
You. Thank you very much. Barbara is on the line from Stowe, Vermont. Hi, Barbara. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? Now I'm feeling very guilty after that last remark because I've known to go outside on my balcony at about 10 o'clock when the birds are sleeping and do a whistle of a different bird call, and then one will wake up. And I think it's really driving them crazy. Anyway, my comment and question is about hummingbirds. Uh-huh. The question is, do the same ones come back to me yearly? Because they seem to know me, mm-hmm. and they dive bomb me to mm-hmm. tell me to get that feeder out. Mm-hmm. And last year,
yeah.
I was sitting in at my kitchen counter with mm-hmm. my computer, the door open, and one actually flew in. Also, there was mm-hmm. another door on the same side of the house, totally open. Mm-hmm. It flew in, stopped about a foot and a half in front of my face, mm-hmm. hung there for a minute, turned around and flew out.
Mm-hmm. My goodness, that's a great story.
It's just like a real... Pardon me?
It's a wonderful story, Barbara.
I mean, I just couldn't believe it because there was another door open, you know, mm-hmm. 10 feet down the front mm-hmm. of the house.
Getting mm-hmm. your attention. Barbara, thanks so much. Is it the same family coming back every year, Barbara wants to know?
Well, it certainly is with some birds. The same ones come back to the same place. So they migrate thousands of miles and come back to the exact same spot, to the same territory, to the same neighbors, to the same feeding spots. You know, I've noticed, for example, I was watching the tree swallows. I got a whole bunch of birdhouses out, and I open the boxes and look at, see how they're doing, what the young are doing, the eggs and so on. So the swallows dive bomb me, but if somebody else goes out there, they don't dive bomb. They only dive bomb me, so they recognize me. But early in the spring, you know, I go out there, and they already dive bomb me, so I think they recognize me.
You talk about other birds. What about hummingbirds specifically?
Hummingbirds specifically, I've heard people say the same thing, that they've had, you know, they feed hummingbirds. I think the hummingbirds come back to that specific. They know that's where the feeder is. They fed there all year, and they come back. It's very likely that they're the same ones. Mm.
Let's go to Somerville, Massachusetts. Louise is on the line. Welcome to the program, Louise.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a question about butterflies.
Okay.
Also, fireflies, how to be able to get them back. This is also related to light pollution, because we were speaking of the stars in the night, but we have a house which looks onto a small playing field with Siberian elms, and I'm afraid that we our house flashes plenty of light into these trees, which I feel sorry for. So there's that question. And just in general, I think that most of us would like to know much more about how to care for the birds who still accept living in cities. That's it.
Thank you, Louise. Well, first question about butterflies and fireflies and light pollution. If they leave, will they come back?
Well, first of all, butterflies and fireflies, there are quite a few species of butterflies, many species of fireflies, and they all have different requirements. So some of them, you know, for example, will be up in the trees and some of them down in the grass. So it depends on, you know, if you have a variety of habitat, variety of many different kinds of plants and flowers, you know, that's the best situation, as it is in nature, for having these animals around. And if you only have a lawn of one type of grass, you're not going to have very much of anything.
And as far as birds generally, Louise was curious how to care for them as humans.
How to care for them? Nesting places is important, and a variety of habitat. Habitat is usually the main limitation for most animals.
Tom is on the line from South Carolina. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering, well, people across the street have tons of hummingbirds. We are using the exact same thing that they have. why are we not getting as many hummingbirds as they are?
Tom, I love your question. How old are you, my friend?
I am 13.
13. Best of luck to you with your hummingbirds. My little ones want hummingbirds to come, too. What do we do? What are we doing wrong? Tom's neighbors are getting them. He's not getting them.
Okay. Well, the thing is, maybe Tom's recently put out the feeder, and the birds already have a good place to go, and they most animals don't like the new situation, and so it'll take them a while to get used to. And unless there's competition there, you know, then they get driven off. Then
so there's no way to lure them. Lure them.
Well, he could try putting this feeder a little bit closer, so it's close to the next one, and then he go to both, and then he gradually move it over.
It sounds like a lot of work to me.
or maybe he's got a different solution. Just check to see if one has more sugar than the other
Sweeten it up a little.
Sweeten it up a little.
There you go, Tom. Karen is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course.
I have a question for Dr. Conrick. I have bats in my house. They come out generally midsummer towards late summer. And I'm wondering what I can do to get them out of my house. And if I were to set up a bat house in my backyard, would it lure them away from the house? However, the bat house would only end up being like 30 feet from my house because I have a small yard.
All right, Karen, thank you.
Yeah, I know bats. So you're really fortunate to have bats because they're suffering now from a fungus that's just killing them off. Wholesale all over the East, and so you know, I would be thankful to have bats around. Of course, you might not like them flying around in the house. It depends on, you know, I don't know where they are bothering. If they're up in the attic or in the walls, or
are they dangerous or just bothersome?
Well, supposedly some of them can carry rabies. So you don't want to get bit by them. I've seen them once in a while at a house, and I'm, you know, always anxious to have them. But they're basically on the outside where there's a crack between the boards or something like that, or behind a board.
Is Karen stuck? Is there any way? She's wondering from an environmental perspective, from a scientist, if she could do anything about it.
Well, she can try the bat house. I put up a couple of bat houses, supposedly good bat houses. I've never had bats going into it, so I'm not an expert on this.
Dan is calling now from New Hampshire. Dan, welcome to the program. I appreciate you waiting.
Hello.
Hi.
I have discovered what I believe to be some sort of wasp
that gestates in the alimentary canal of a small mammal and have not yet found a biologist who knows about it. I have video evidence. I wonder if the professor knows anything or would like to hear anything.
If anyone would know, I think Dr. Heinrich would. Well, do you?
Well, I'm really not an expert on wasps, and I know quite a few wasps, but I've never heard of one in the alimentary canal of what?
Of mammals.
Well, mice, mostly.
Mice?
I gather moles as well. I'm sure about mice.
So are you sure it's not some kind of a fly?
A fly? Oh, could be. Could be a fly,
yeah.
Sure.
Well, there are lots of fly parasites.
Uh-huh.
And some flies actually mimic wasps and bumblebees, so you hardly tell them apart.
Very likely a fly. I have not yet found the adult in a way I can.
Rear them out.
Pardon me?
Rear them out and see what the adult is, and send it to me, and I'll identify it for you.
May I have your address?
Well, we'll put it online, sir. That's quite an offer. Thank you very much for calling, Dan. Lance is calling from Kittery Point, Maine. Lance, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of Dr. Heinrich's. I've read most of his books. And my question is, my house here in Kittery Point, Maine, is being devoured by carpenter bees. And these are a new species, which I've never seen before. I've lived here for 62 years. And the last few years, I've had a big problem with them eating holes in my house. These are big, fat bees that eat wood, and they make little round holes in various parts of my house and leave big piles of sawdust. And what can I do to stop them, and what are they doing, and why are they here?
Well, it's interesting. I've haven't seen any carpenter bees in western Maine where I am, so they're generally very common in the south, so apparently they're starting to move north now, so maybe I'll see them up here fairly soon. Anyways, they dig holes in the wood, and they lay their eggs and put pollen in there and rear the larvae in a protected place. So instead of, like honeybees making combs out of wax and having them in a hollow, they make their own little tiny hollow. And there are other bees that make use natural holes from beetle larvae, for example, and others dig holes in the sand. So these are solitary bees, and they're very, they look a lot like bumblebees to a lot of people, but they're very, very potentially very destructive. Yeah,
indeed. Jill is on the line now from Newport News, Virginia. Hi, Jill. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
First comment, I kind of stumbled on raising black swallowtail butterflies about 3 years ago. I came in and noticed all my parsley was gone and realized it was the caterpillars to black swallowtail. So I started raising them and whatnot, got a little pavilion and, watched them do their thing. I had probably 8 or 10 chrysalis left over last year in the winter, and just kind of forgot them in the pavilion, and already I've seen 2 black swallowtails emerge just in this last week. My question is, when I took them out of the pavilion to let them go, they seemed that there was no inkling to fly away. In fact, they stayed there in the garden for about 2 days, basically on the same plant that I put them on. And then when I came home, they were gone. I wondered, did they finally fly away, or did something happen to them, and I just haven't found the remains?
Professor?
Well, I can't answer specifically, what happened to them. But, often butterflies have to shiver and warm up before they can fly away. So, you can take many insects and, you think they could fly. You throw them up in the air, and they drop down, and because they decided not to warm up. So it could have been that was cold, and then it got warm, and then they flew away. Also, I don't know where Newport News, where that is, but I was surprised that there was some emerging already. It seems like a pavilion, I don't know, is that heated, or maybe they were hatching out earlier than they normally would, if it was warmer than the outside.
Well, it's delightful to have you here, Professor Bernd Heinrich, Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Vermont, one of the preeminent scientists in this country, author of the new book, Summer World, A Season of Bounty. Thank you for your time and your thoughts, your perspectives. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Jane.
Thanks
for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.